I do think of him as more of a world figure than, say, a Rick Warren or a Jerry Falwell. So I guess I would normally hold him to a higher standard. And it seems to me that it's not a very difficult task to visit a Holocaust museum and say something meaningful and profound there. It's really not that difficult for a man with I don't know how many speechwriters to recognize the harm that his country did, that his religion did, that his people did in murdering tens of millions of people. 6 million Jews, 5 million non-Jews, gypsies, gay people. For Jews, of course, the Holocaust was a uniquely horrible event. One out of every three Jews in the entire world were murdered. And yet the Pope's speech seemed very calm. Remember, this Pope was a member of Hitler Youth. This Pope served in the German army. This Pope made tank traps to try to prevent the Allies from defeating Hitler's army. Now, I don't dispute that Pope Benedict XVI, Cardinal Ratzenberger, I don't dispute. I'm not claiming he was some huge Nazi. He wasn't. No, I think he was an ordinary German. Many Germans did not join Hitler Youth. It was not compulsory, which is what the Vatican says. There were lots of Nazi laws that people violated. They didn't go to concentration camps and they weren't shot. No doubt it was easier to join Hitler Youth. And I'm not saying that the Pope did so because he believed in the ideals of Adolf Hitler. I'm just saying he did what most people did. They were scared. They took the easy way out. They joined Hitler Youth. They were in the German military. Cardinal Ratzenberger, Pope Benedict XVI, let's just say, was no Oscar Schindler. His name would not be found as one of the righteous Gentiles in the Yad Vashem yard, people who risked their lives serving in the resistance, trying to save lives. But okay, all right, it's not my job to hold the Pope to a higher moral standard. Fair enough, that's the job of a billion Catholics. But I was reading through and listening to the speech that Pope Benedict XVI gave at Yad Vashem. And I was comparing it to the speech another pope, his predecessor, gave at Yad Vashem. And I couldn't help but remark upon the differences. Now, Pope John Paul II, I guess, had an easier time of it because he had less moral conflict. He was Polish. He actually worked and helped the resistance. He did what more Poles did, just as Benedict did what most Germans did. In reading John Paul II's speech, he talks about his own personal memories of what happened, how he remembers his Jewish friends and neighbors who are stripped of everything, especially of human dignity. This is from Pope John Paul II's speech. He talks about the just Gentiles that saved so many lives. He talked about the evil of Nazism. And while it is a beautiful speech that Pope John Paul II gave, you know, the Holocaust is really not that hard to speak profoundly about evil. Indeed, I think the Holocaust is too often trivialized. It seems that everyone and their dog wants to compare someone to Hitler or Nazism or fascism. And in doing so, I think they lessen the impact of the greatest crime of the 20th century. I mean, I detest Dick Cheney, but he's no Hitler. And I think that people regularly, you know, left and right, use Hitler as if there's not a single Democrat or Republican that comes close. But when you come to this Pope, who was a member of Hitler Youth, who did serve in Hitler's army. Admittedly, he was no general. He was no leader. He got out of it when he could. He wasn't an ordinary German, so to speak. You think that he would mention some personal remembrance of his own? You think that he would say, "I'm sorry"? He would recognize that the things he joined did profoundly evil, awful things. I mean, it's easy to explain away. Again, he was 16, he was 18. I don't hold him to a higher moral stance, but if he proclaims to be this person that the Catholics consider infallible, how about talking about his own fallibility? Talk about what difficultness causes ordinary people to become vicious, brutal murderers. The kind that smash babies against the wall for sport. The kind that gas tens of thousands of men, women, and tiny little children. 1.5 million of the 6 million were children. And do so gleefully. One of the things that Daniel Goldhagen, professor at Harvard, who wrote the book Ordinary Germans, taught me so well was how common and joyful this massacre was. In his book, he has a photo postcard from a soldier. An astonishing thing. This German soldier sent a postcard to his girlfriend of him posing with a gun as he shoots at a woman holding a baby. It frankly, it sounds so unbelievable, but Professor Goldhagen is quite a scholar. He has a clear replication of this postcard. And there's the soldier grinning as he shoots at a baby being held in its mother's arms as they cower before he kills them both. On the back, in German, he writes, "Greetings from the war front," or something to that effect. The Nazis were not these crazed murderers that were mentally ill and high on drugs, and, you know, they're not like the guy that shot up Virginia Tech who was hearing voices. No, they were ordinary people. They had sons and daughters. They loved their children. Recently, I was, about a year ago, I was in the camp, Theresienstadt, in the Czech Republic. And just outside the concentration camp, where the Nazis brutalized their prisoners, was the Nazis' playground for their own kids. Jewish kids had to die and be shot. German kids could prosper, and they had quite a nice little playground, where the kids must have heard the screams on the other side of the wall. Is it too much to ask the Pope, the first German Pope, to mention Germany's role in this? Is it too much to ask the head of Catholicism to apologize on behalf of the Catholic Church for the actions of Pope Pius XII, a man that apparently this Pope wants to make a saint? A man who quietly shelved the encyclical of the prior pope, Pope Pius XI, who would have been the first Catholic pope to actually condemn anti-Semitism, to actually speak out on behalf of the Jews. Unfortunately, Pope Pius XI died. Pius XII came to power, and he shelved that. He said nothing as the Nazis proceeded with their final solution. Indeed, Hitler was Catholic, born Catholic, and he could have excommunicated him. Would have been a very strong sign to the Catholics. He didn't do that either. Now, this Pope, at best, was silent. At worst, was craven. Yes, he was afraid. He was afraid. He was a human being. Given this history, given the fact that it's The Catholic Church put Hitler in power in 1933. You may not know this. Hitler never won an election. He won a plurality. They did not win a majority in any democratic election. In the last election in 1933, he won a plurality. And the Catholic Party, the Zentrum, they called it, put him over the top to make him chancellor. Is this worthy of an apology? Listen to the words of Pope Benedict XVI at Yad Vashem, at the Museum of the Holocaust in Jerusalem. Now, he didn't say awful things. He didn't say he's pro-Nazi. But let's listen to his words.
May the names of his victims never perish. May their suffering never be denied, belittled, or forgotten.
So far, so good. He's not for Holocaust denial, even though we all know that he allowed excommunication of the Holocaust-denying bishop in England. But listen to go on what he said.
And may all people of good will remain vigilant in rooting out from the heart of men anything that could lead to tragedies such as this. The Catholic Church, committed to the teachings of Jesus and intent on imitating his love for all people, feels deep compassion for the victims remembered here. Similarly, she draws close to all those who today are subjected to persecution on account of race, color, condition of life, or religion. Their sufferings are his.
Now, that may have been hard to understand. He does have a strong accent. So let me repeat what he said. He said that the Holocaust was a tragedy. A tragedy. To me, the same words that he said could easily have been said in response to a typhoon or an earthquake. He talks about, you know, the loss of innocent lives. But no one in here, is there any understanding or any explanation or any apology for where the Catholic Church was in all this, for where Germany was in all this. The Pope needed to only say two words at Yad Vashem. He needed to say, I'm sorry. Or we're sorry. He needed to recognize the role that his institution played and the role that he played, frankly, as a cog in that wheel. You can't get over something like this. Well, you can never get over something like this, but there's no way to move on and to build ties without an apology. I have always strongly urged the United States government, the United States Congress, to issue an apology for slavery. Frankly, it should have been done 150 years ago, much less 100 or 50 years ago. We need to apologize for the genocide committed on Native Americans. But those crimes, which there is no justification for, at least are beyond the distance of personal memory. They are in history now. They still affect us. There's no question that the decimation of Native Americans affects them. Native Americans, of course, there's fewer of them now than there were at the time that white people came to these shores, just like there are fewer Jews now than there were in 1939. There are very few peoples you can say that about whose numbers have gone down in 60 years dramatically. There were 18 million Jews in 1939, 12 in 1945, 12 million and only about 14 million today. Slavery has forever haunted the African Americans. But mass murder is not a tragedy. A tragedy is something that awful that befalls like fate a group of innocent people. Mass murder is caused by human beings. It has a cause, it has an effect. And the groups of which this Pope was a part caused the murders. And Hitler Youth was training the next generation. Is it too much for him to say, as even the German Chancellor Helmut Kohl did? Look, Helmut Kohl, you can disagree with him, but he understood, as the Chancellor of Germany, that when he came to Yad Vashem, he owed an abject apology And he gave one. I would hope it was cleansing for him. The Catholic Church owes that same kind of cleansing apology. They still to this day will not release their files to show what they knew and when they knew it. And that's because scholars believe the Catholic Church knew all about the mass murders and did nothing to stop them. Throughout the Holocaust, all kinds of leaders, Jewish, Catholic, came to the Pope, Pius XII, begging him to speak out, and he refused. He said very little. Maybe he was just afraid. Maybe he, just being a human being, simply didn't want to speak out because he was afraid the Nazis would topple him. Okay, people are human. I understand that. I'm not blaming Pope Benedict XVI for at age 16 or 18 joining Hitler Youth and joining the German military for not avoiding the draft. Okay, he wasn't brave enough to join the resistance. I don't hold him to a higher standard. But shouldn't Catholics? Compare him again with Pope John Paul II, a man who served in the resistance. No one's asking him to be perfect, but I would think that what he could do is simply say, this isn't a tragedy. This is evil. That's the word that Pope John Paul II used. He said evil. And then when he goes on to say that the Catholic Church feels compassion for the victims. Compassion? Compassion. For the victims. Compassion. You know, to me that'd be kind of like, I don't know, a descendant of a great Ku Klux Klan killer saying he has compassion for the people his father lynched. I feel so bad. I feel for them. You know, they were lynched. And then he goes on to say that the sufferings are hers. This is the part you may not have understood through his accent, that the sufferings are somehow those of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was behind those sufferings, as well as Protestant churches, as well as Islam. And let's face it, we have the Mufti of Jerusalem wanting to join with Hitler to bring the Holocaust to Palestine. Here's the thing that Europeans don't get, and that Americans do get, and I've lived in Europe. I lived there for a year. I studied in Switzerland for a year. The funny thing is, Americans get it. They understand the horror. Maybe because there are Jews left in America who can help people understand. The Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. is very well done. Maybe because their hands are not full of blood, that Americans understand the horror of the Holocaust. Maybe Pope John Paul II could understand because he was Polish. And Pope Benedict XVI just can't get away from his German heritage. But a pope, as a moral leader, should get away from that. He should understand that he has an obligation that's broader than trying to protect himself from the charges of what he did in his past. That he is a representative of more than 1 billion people. The sufferings were not those of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church caused the sufferings. At best, they stood by while small murder occurred. At worst, they actively did those murders. The largest death camps were run by people who were putative Catholics. They went to Mass. And the same priest that today would deny a John Kerry or a Barack Obama the wafer, well, John Kerry is Catholic, so they denied him that in 2004 because he supports a woman's right to choose. The same ones who are protesting him, Barack Obama, in Notre Dame because of his position on abortion, did nothing to deny the wafer to the people who are murdering tens of thousands of people with their own hands. Whatever you think of abortion, whatever you think, clearly killing people who are 6 and 10 and 22 and 52 has got to be a more, or at least equally severe crime to ending a pregnancy early. So, yes, I was very disappointed, and I remember listening to the speech and thinking, when is he going to get to the apology? I mean, it's not that much to ask. When's he going to get to the point where he says, I'm sorry? The German people are sorry. We have done our best to reform. The Catholic Church is sorry. And in many ways, the Catholic Church has reformed. I mean, John the 23rd did some amazing things with Vatican II. They no longer blame Jews for killing Jesus. That was a huge step forward. Pope John Paul II, again, said some beautiful things about rebuilding Jewish-Christian relationships. Pope Benedict XVI, he may not just not have the poetry of John Paul II. But I have to think part of it is protecting his German background. Is trying to suggest, well, maybe, you know, these horrible tragedies happen. I'd like to see him do more. Let's take a break. The toll-free number is 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Please give me a call. When we come back, I want to talk about a different kind of prejudice, homophobia, and a bunch of black preachers taking advantage of it. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also download off our website over at progressive.org. Soon after getting into the White House, Barack Obama said bemusedly that some of his opponents were still fighting the New Deal. But now it looks like Obama himself may chip away at one of the cornerstones of the New Deal, and that is Social Security. After announcing that the recession has shrunk the payroll taxes that fund Social Security, Obama's pathetic Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner signaled that cuts in the program may be in the offing. Said Geithner, the president explicitly rejects the notion that Social Security is untouchable politically. And Obama himself uses the derisive term entitlement for this benefit as if the elderly and the disabled are acting like entitled little brats to expect to have any government help. The most outrageous thing about this is that it's so unnecessary. Even with this week's figures, Social Security would be able to pay every dime of benefits to every recipient through the year 2037. And if we simply lifted the ceiling on Social Security payroll taxes, then Social Security would be solvent a lot longer. Obama campaigned on preserving Social Security and accused McCain of wanting to cut it, now in a huge betrayal. Obama's preparing to cut it himself. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I've been talking about my disappointment in the Pope. You know, it's weird that I would even care. Like I said, I laugh a lot at some of the radical Protestant preachers who are far, far, far worse. I mean, no one's saying that the Pope is as bad as like the Pastor Keller I had before. But the Catholic Church, I think back to the molestation scandals, right? The Catholic Church knew that was going on, but they just wanted to deny it. It was safer simply to deny it, and it only took a huge hullabaloo to get them to mention it and talk about it. Contrast it to, you may have heard this, a priest who had sex with a woman. Well, he's on all the talk shows. The Vatican's talking about him a lot, Father Cudier. But I think it takes a bit of pressure. And this, of course, is the Pope who used an ancient text to attack the Islamic faith. He's the Pope that allowed the Holocaust denier, Bishop Richard Williamson, back into the church. And it's important to understand how all of this affects not just Jews, but the people of Israel. The people of Israel right now are, well, they're in a bind. You have Hamas in control of Gaza. Israel left to get some kind of peace, and Hamas is still, to this day, raining missiles into southern Israel. And so the people are scared, and they've turned to the right. They've turned to Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, who right now says that he doesn't support a Palestinian state. I think that's wrong. I do support a Palestinian state. But I think that Netanyahu is an effect, not a cause. Israel's a very famous fractious democracy can fall on a dime, and they can put in someone else if they have a peace treaty. What does this have to do with the Pope? I think that if the people of Israel understand that Europe understands the crime that it did and the suffering it caused, just that kind of recognition could actually allow the people of Israel to make some more concessions. After all, it's a very scary thing to make concessions. This is the people that just recently survived annihilation, and they're being asked to give over territory that may well lead to their annihilation. So it's very hard to take an existential risk when you have the leader of the Catholic Church come to their country and isn't even able to say, I'm sorry for the Holocaust. Which is why I think Israelis listen far more to Americans than they do to Europeans. Here, the Holocaust happened in Europe, and virtually every European was in some way involved. Either they committed the crime, or they sat still while the crimes happened, or very, very few, there were absolutely some heroes in the resistance. And yet, if you look back at the history of the Catholic Church, when Theodore Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, came to the Vatican in 1904 to plead with Pope Pius X, the Pope told him, and this is a direct quote, Jews have not recognized our Lord, therefore we cannot recognize the Jewish people. Herzl said, well, maybe persecuting and killing and massacring them isn't the answer. But the Pope said, quote, they had ample time to acknowledge Christ's divinity without pressure, but they didn't. It was the policy of the Catholic Church to put pressure on the Jews. Maybe if you send them to the gas chamber, maybe then they'll recognize the Prince of Peace, Jesus. Because we all know that we all turn to a peaceful practitioner of nonviolence when our children are being gassed and we're being tortured. But this was the official Catholic Church view given by the Pope himself. The Jews need that pressure. It is not their view today. Again, with Vatican II and John the 23rd, the Catholic Church doesn't teach this anymore. But is it so much to ask them to recognize their own past? The U.S. ambassador to the Vatican wrote in 1942, telling him the details of the reports of hundreds of thousands of Jews from Poland, Belgium, Holland, France, and Slovakia who were being gassed. He asked if the Vatican could verify the report and if the Holy Father would condemn the barbarities. The Vatican responded that it had no practical suggestions to make. None. And even in 1943, the Vatican was arguing that the Holocaust victims should die rather than go to Palestine. They should stay in Germany. The Catholic Church has a lot to apologize for. And I don't think that the Pope has to give a detailed rendition of all of its crimes. But if he's asking Israel to make sacrifices for peace, he could do one very simple thing. Doesn't require any kind of policy oriented. It doesn't require discussion of settlements or the Palestinians or just simply apologize for the Holocaust. You know, in the same vein, in this country, I find that black-white relations would be so much better if we white Americans would simply apologize for slavery. Now, unlike the Pope, who served briefly in Hitler's youth in the German army, I didn't own slaves. My grandparents didn't own slaves. My great-grandparents didn't own slaves. My family came to this shores in the 1890s and 1900s. But as an American, I feel we have an obligation to recognize these horrors. That is why I'm glad that finally, and this is, again, taken way too long, there will be a museum on the Washington Mall, a history of African Americans that will focus, I'm sure, on many things, but definitely talk about the horrors of slavery. We need to teach more Americans what happened to the Native American population in this country. Many were brutally massacred. Some, admittedly, was done by disease. Some was done by the spread of smallpox unintentionally. Some was done by the spread of smallpox intentionally as missionaries gave Native Americans blankets. This is part of our history. And if we're ever going to try to heal racial relations in America, if we're ever going to try, and there's very few Native Americans left, but to understand our own history and to dialogue, if you will, with the people whom we replaced, we've got to recognize our own history and apologize for it. I'm amazed when these slavery apology resolutions go around state to state that there are people who vote against them, mostly Republicans. They actually argue, yeah, we don't need to apologize for slavery. What? We don't apologize enough. What harm is there in these words? It's just words. I'm not even arguing for reparations. Just words. To recognize the evil that occurred. Now, all this is wrapped up in my mind, and it's to a far lesser extent, to be clear, far lesser extent, but it's all wrapped up in my mind with the torture memo. I don't think you can get past a crime until you fully expose and, yes, apologize for everything that's been done. Now, I am not saying that the torture is in any way approaching slavery or genocide. But it still goes with the same point that you, in order to move on, you've got to recognize what was done, investigate it, and move on. Because otherwise, people don't feel confident. Even Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, who was in the KKK, tearfully apologized for his conduct. Now, it could have just been crocodile tears. I don't know. I can't see into Robert Byrd's heart. Maybe Helmut Kohl, the German chancellor, was just giving crocodile tears at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. Maybe so. But you know what? I accept that. Is it too much to ask the German Pope to give a teary apology for the crimes of Germany and the Catholic Church? Is it too much to ask him to understand the horrors, that they weren't just some tragedy, that they were an act of evil from mankind? And thinking about all of this, many of you know I have a local radio show in Washington. And I did a show last night that you're going to hear on the horn this Friday. I hope you'll tune in during my hour. You'll hear the dialogue show. It's a show that I do jointly with a couple other local radio hosts, Garland Nixon and Terry Kester. And I woke up this morning thinking I didn't do a really good job. The show was on the fact that the former mayor of Washington, D.C., Marion Barry, yes, the famous Marion Barry, the crack addict, the guy that didn't pay his taxes, the guy who was married four times, divorced four times, and was caught in a room smoking crack with a woman, not his wife, who was an FBI agent and famously said, the B word set me up. Yes, that Marion Barry. That Marion Barry was the sole member of the D.C. City Council to vote against recognition of out-of-state marriages when those marriages happen to be of gay couples. And Marion Barry argued it was a morality thing, this man who is high on crack and has had four wives and divorces and adulteries and didn't pay his taxes, didn't even file tax returns and may go to jail for it. He argued it was a question of morality. But when you listen further to what he had to say, he said the black community is adamantly against this. So he seemed to blame the inequality of gay people on black people. And all I could think about was divide and conquer. Right? That's what the rich whites did with the poor whites back in slavery times, right? It never should we forget that three-quarters of the Confederates, the white soldiers fighting for the South and for their state, three-quarters of the white folk in the South didn't even own slaves. But they fought nonetheless for the right of the one-quarter, the rich, to own those slaves. If you put together the African-Americans along with the non-slave-owning whites, you have a vast majority of the South. But the whites, the poor whites, still with the rich whites, rather than the slaves. Divide and conquer. And right now, you can see white evangelicals are using black preachers to try to divide the gay community and the black community. And no one gets more divided than those that are both black and gay. And so there's this preacher, a guy by the name of Bishop Harry Jackson, someone, by the way, who I've had on my show, because, as you know, I like to bring on my show people with whom I disagree, and he I disagree with very strongly. I had him on my show about a year ago. Bishop Jackson is funded by James Dobson and Tony Perkins and Lou Sheldon and all those white evangelical homophobes that have done so much to try to persecute gay people. He is a man who claims to be a Democrat. He's black. But he voted for George Bush and John McCain and said that if Barack Obama wins, there'll be darkness across the land. And yet he is claiming, like Marion Barry, that black people don't want gay equality. Well, I have news for Marion Barry and for Bishop Harry Jackson. Proud news, in fact. On the D.C. City Council sit 7 African-Americans and 6 white people. And of the 7 blacks, 6 of them voted for marriage equality, as did 6 whites. Only crack addict, four times married and four times adultered, Marion Barry, voted against it. And the black mayor voted for it. But this attempt to divide black people and gay people. It just reminds me, I guess, of what the rich whites did to the poor whites before the South and before the Civil War. What some have tried to do with blacks and Jews. Now they're doing with blacks and gays. Or sometimes they try to divide Latinos. It's the Democratic Party has always been, well, that's not true. Let's just say for the last 50 years, the Democratic Party has been the party of those that are left out 40 years since the Civil Rights era. And we look out for women's rights, and we look out for gay rights, and we look out for African-American rights, and Asian and Latino and Jewish and poor people, too. Now, when you add it all up, it turns out to be quite the majority of Americans. And it really offended me that they're using race as a way to suggest that somehow black civil rights were more important than gay civil rights. You don't compare civil rights. Black civil rights are vitally important to America. Gay civil rights are vitally important to America. All American civil rights are vitally important to America. And when I did my show yesterday, I have to say, I don't know that I conveyed it well enough. There were a lot of callers. Many were black. Many were opposed to gay equality. And I don't think that I conveyed, I guess, enough of the concern. And so I was reading an article on PamsHouseBlend.com. I happen to know Pam Spaulding. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. And I think she conveyed it much better. And I will get to what she had to say. But first, I want to talk to Kevin in New York. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hi. Usually the reason why things like this happen is because a lot of oppressed people feel they won't be as oppressed if they oppress others. It's like during times of slavery. Huh?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's like the poor whites during slavery.
Yeah, it's like, well, not even poor whites, other black people. A lot of the slave catchers, most of the slave catchers were black.
That's true, and in Africa particularly.
Yeah, but even on this side, you know, it's the same thing with preachers against civil rights when the icon of, I guess, the black church, Martin Luther King, was very pro-gay rights.
He was. He was shockingly pro-gay rights. Bayard Rustin, of course, stood by his side. A lot of people in the civil rights movement did not want Bayard Rustin there because he's gay. He was gay. And Martin Luther King said, no, this is the guy that brought us here. He organized the March on Washington. Martin Luther King was pro-gay at a time in the 1960s when homosexuality was defined as a disease. That's how much foresight Martin Luther King had. Amazing, really.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, and I'm going to, and I am going to out somebody on the show because he is very anti-gay, even though he is Ron Christie, the news commentator on MSNBC.
Okay.
You know, he takes a lot of stances that are very homophobic when he himself is. Who?
His name? I don't mind adding someone who's homophobic. Well, what's the name of the commentator? I didn't get the name.
Ron Christie. He's black.
Ron Christie. Okay, I'm gonna look him up
because
it doesn't ring a bell with me. But
yeah, he's on MSNBC. You know, he was on the staffer for Dick Cheney. It all goes down to like a lot of black conservatives. They feel they can get ahead by acting in contrary to the interests of 90-some-odd percent of their people.
Hang on with me, Kevin, because I want to take this argument one step further, one step
scarier,
something that I guess I didn't have the courage to do last night, and maybe that's why I'm hitting myself this morning, and I'm doing penance by talking about it now. Pam Spaulding had the courage to do something that I didn't have the courage to do last night. Pam Spaulding is attacking Barack Obama. Now, Pam is black. I don't know whether Pam is gay or straight. She may well be gay. I don't know. I just don't know how to know her sexual orientation. But Pam points out what everybody knows, which is that Barack Obama is solely against marriage equality for political reasons. All of us know that in 1996, when he was a state senator from Illinois, Barack Obama said that he supported marriage equality and he would work to elect people who supported marriage equality. Now, this was 1996. Let's think back how far this is in time, right? Marriage became legal in Massachusetts in 2004. Civil unions first started in Vermont in 1999. 3 years before that, when Barack Obama wasn't running for president, when he wasn't running for senator, he took a very, at that time, a radically equal position, a wonderful position. So I give a lot of credit to the Barack Obama of 1996. But Pam points out, quite rightly, that we all know that Barack Obama's view today is a dodge. As he writes, and this is Pam writing, quoting from The Audacity of Hope, Barack Obama's 2006 book. This is what Barack Obama wrote in 2006. He wrote, "It is my obligation, not only as an elected official in a pluralistic society, but also as a Christian, to remain open to the possibility that my unwillingness to support gay marriage is misguided, and that in years hence, I may be seen as someone who is on the wrong side of history." Unquote. Mm-hmm. Now, President Obama is a very, very smart man. And in that book, he wrote himself a little loophole. In other words, Obama knows that marriage equality is right. He supported it 10 years earlier in 1996 when very, very few politicians supported it. But he also knew that in order to get elected president of the United States, he couldn't in 2008 say he supported marriage equality. And I understand that political dodge. I get it. I get it. Sometimes you have to – in fact, Marion Barry, I think, is doing the same thing. Sometimes you have to say things you don't believe in order to get elected. I get it. But Pam takes it one step further, and this is where I think she was brave, and I don't think I was brave enough. Pam points out that the opponents of marriage equality are citing Obama left and right, and she calls it one of his unintended consequences. She understands that President Obama, in order to get elected, had to pretend that he was against equality. But at the same time, now that it's coming state by state, you find that all the opponents are citing Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So my belief is that President Obama, after being reelected, and I think he will be reelected in 2012, let me be the first to say that, in 2013 will come down solidly in favor of marriage equality. And that's, I think, is his plan. But he's got 4 years, and he's afraid to do it right now. And it's really hard for a man who I think is generally a principled human being but is a politician to stick with his dodge. And that's what I did today, yesterday, and I kind of wish I had.
I agree with you 100%. You know, it's, come on, you know, there's that big thing called Middle America, which doesn't change. And as much as you want to speed up progress, those people don't change. I've lived amongst those people. And it's like sometimes banging, you cannot take a sledgehammer and chip away at them. It's like water on a statue. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, I do. I'll tell you what I thought about when I read Pam's article. I couldn't help but remember that in 1963, John F. Kennedy told Martin Luther King, "In no uncertain terms, don't march." He couldn't have been clearer. He said, "Don't march." He did not give them a permit to march. Kennedy opposed the March on Washington. Now, do I think John F. Kennedy was opposed to racial equality? I do not. I think John Kennedy, an intelligent man, And a guy with a good heart and a liberal heart, I think John Kennedy was always for racial equality, just like I think that Barack Obama is for marriage equality. But John Kennedy, being a politician who was running for re-election in 1964, was saying to Martin Luther King, "Not yet. It's not time yet. Let me win re-election, you know, then we'll help you." And King said, basically, if not now, when? He said it much more eloquently, and I don't remember his exact words, but he basically said, "You can always put us off. We have to do what we have to do. There will always be a reason for delay." Mm-hmm. And to me, what's fascinating, and what I would love to tell President Obama if I could ever see him face to face, is you're being John Kennedy right now. You know you're on the wrong side of history. You've admitted it in your book. Will you be braver than President Kennedy? And I don't know whether he will be. But I think he's starting to understand exactly where he is historically.
Yeah, well, as a politician, you can't be. You know, it is a profession for cowards.
Well, let me give you someone who wasn't a coward. All right? Someone who was profoundly wrong on Vietnam. You got to say that whenever you say his name. Baines Johnson was an amazing human being. If we could take Vietnam out, and we never can, but both for racial equality and the war on poverty, Lyndon Johnson said when he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, I am signing away the Democratic Party in the South for a generation. He knew exactly.
He knew
it was politically wrong and morally right, and you know what? He did it anyway. And I don't know why we have all these Kennedy memorials, maybe because he was assassinated, and Kennedy coins, and yes, there was Vietnam, but I don't see many, many monuments to Lyndon Baines Johnson. And you got to give that old, crusty, kind of crooked Texan a lot of credit for what he did, because he didn't have to do it.
Yeah. I do give him brave points for that, but I guess it's true. It's kind of like the lesser of two evils, I think. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But Vietnam, I think, if it wasn't for Vietnam...
I'm not going to justify the actions of Vietnam. Listen, but on civil rights, he was clearly a hero.
Absolutely,
Kennedy.
But I think how he was able to get over on civil rights was the Vietnam thing. Because that pacified the right wing.
Well, neither side was pacified, as you know from history. In 1968, in Chicago, the Democrats, liberals were riding in the streets. The Republicans were supporting Nixon. Johnson was hated by both sides.
Because the thing is, you cannot do in politics to screw the military-industrial complex. Why do you think we're still in Afghanistan?
There's no doubt that's true. I guess the voice that didn't get heard yesterday when I was, and you're going to hear that show on Friday, and I'd like folks to listen to it because I had two co-hosts and I had a lot of callers, and there was a lot going on, and I don't know that I conveyed it as eloquently as Pam Spalding did. But Pam quotes others, and she quotes a black gay man who, let me just read. This is a quote of a quote of a quote, but I'm going to read it because I think it's right on. This man writes, "For me, civil rights is civil rights is civil rights. Equal protection under the law is equal protection under the law. In employment, in housing, in public accommodations, in adoption, in civil marriage. Either we all have it or we don't."
Absolutely.
Which is really powerful. I hadn't even thought about this. When a person has no recourse to force an undertaker to come and take a corpse out of their home because the survivor is not legally considered the next of kin despite their 30-year relationship, and the dead person's next of kin is thousands of miles away, and because of Alzheimer's, doesn't even remember who the dead person is anymore, but she's the only person alive who, by state law, can force the undertaker to remove the corpse from their house. When you wrap your mind around all the practical and emotional turmoil that results in this situation because of this discrimination, I would argue strongly that that certificate of marriage is more than just a piece of paper. This is but one example. It is not hypothetical either. I can provide many more, several much more devastating. A marriage certificate is akin to an adoption decree and an altered birth certificate. It creates a legal familial relationship. As black people whose ancestors' families were ripped apart by the institution of slavery, how can we stand in opposition to the creation of a family unit and the safety and security, emotional and otherwise, that ensue for all of its members? Tell me, black people, how? And I just wish I hadn't had that to read yesterday, and I didn't. I just thought that was very tough.
Right. It's like, and I think that, you know, as someone who is African American, not of the same faith as the quote unquote black American church, you know, because my faith has been somewhat kinder and gentler to that community, to your community, I 100% agree. You know, based on our past, to me, like, it's almost like racist guilt.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's the other thing. Look, there are racist gay people, there are racist Jews, there are anti-Semitic black people, there are homophobic black people. But I have to say, I think it's a minority. I think that people who know persecution, who know oppression, should see it when it occurs and reach out to it when it occurs. And one of the things that bothers me so much about the attempts by Marion Barry and Bishop Harry Jackson to make this a race war or a sexual orientation war is that they don't seem to seem to try to be fooling us. They're trying to make it faith versus gays or black versus gays when there are black people of faith who don't believe in discrimination.
Yeah.
And that's why one of the things we did, and I've been working on marriage equality in D.C. D.C. passed the recognition law, and I think the marriage equality bill is around the corner. It's in my backyard. It's something I can work on. Is we are bringing out hundreds of preachers and ministers and rabbis and imams and people of all Hindus, Buddhists, people of all religious faiths who believe in marriage equality. Because somehow people get the idea that religion is anti-gay. Well, some religions are, and some are not. And there are plenty of people of faith who have goodwill towards all mankind, which, after all, isn't that what Jesus preached in the first place? The guy who hung out with lepers and prostitutes?
Well, the thing is, you have to understand, a lot of the Protestant faith is based on predestination. Okay, and predestination is based on, you know, the select few.
I'm going to have to end it right there, Kevin, because my time's up. But thank you for calling.
Okay.
I always appreciate when you do. And believe it or not, I see my two things I said today is connected. I think that simple recognition of wrongs being done, recognition of history, recognition and a little bit of humility and apology on behalf of these ministers would go a long way, whether it's toward past crimes or toward future civil rights. Tomorrow I'm going to have a member of Congress who's running against our inspector in the Democratic Party, Joe Sestak. We're going to have him on tomorrow, I hope. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.